This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Istanbul takes food seriously, very seriously. And meyhane restaurants are where it all comes to life. These traditional establishments are all about community, shared plates, loud conversations, and ruckus served as part of the ritual. But take a small detour and the food starts doing something different. As innovators in the kitchen, like Chef Deniz, continue to rewrite the menu.
In Istanbul, new young chefs like me develop the Turkish cuisine, but we don't replace tradition. We give it new life.
Because in Istanbul, food never stands still.
Old flavors, new ideas.
It evolves. Slowly, confidently, one plate at a time. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the space in the metaverse where you, me, the top experts, and a big subject get together for 28 minutes. Last month, the global population hit 8 billion for the first time. Around 800 million of us are aged over 65. By 2050, that number will double to 1.6 billion. The population is aging fast, and birth rates are collapsing. Should we be worried? For years, the accepted mega problem of world demography has been there will be too many of us. Not anymore. Now the worry is that we're getting too old. The number of people over 65 is set to double between now and 2050, and at the same time, the birth rate in most of the world is falling, often sharply. It's a whole new, old world, and it comes with huge social and economic implications. What are they? And what should we think about doing to cope with them? Step into the briefing room and we'll try to find out. First, what do the stats tell us about our direction of travel? Joining me in the briefing room is Stephanie Haggerty, the BBC's global population correspondent. Stephanie, is the world's population getting older?
Yes, absolutely. And pretty much across the board. This is a success story because we're seeing better healthcare and we're seeing better diets. So in almost every country, rich and poor, people are getting older.
How fast is this happening? I mean, in other words, even in what we call less developed countries, are people significantly living older faster, if you see what I mean?
Well, the effect is always uneven, but it's happening very rapidly in the most developed countries. It's happening quite rapidly in the middle-income countries, less so in the lower-income countries. But, you know, we've got a lot of parts of the world now that are middle-income developed, so that's really pushing up the pace of population aging. That's why it's getting faster, and that's why it's becoming such a concern.
So if we were to put a summary on it, the population is still going up, but a significant proportion of that is because people are aging.
Yes, because people are living longer and healthier lives. And at the other end of the scale, children are surviving childbirth. So, you know, we've had, say, 50, 60 years ago, all those children that survived childbirth then are still on the planet now, and starting to age.
Right. Now, let's go to the other side of the equation, which is the birth rate. What's happening to birth rates around the world? And I think this is the point at which you should introduce us to the concept of the replacement rate, Stephanie.
Okay, so this is a really uneven picture. Where aging is happening almost everywhere, birth rates are vastly different. It's all to do with this replacement rate, as you mentioned, and the magic number here is 2.1. So if every woman in a country has 2.1 children, slightly difficult idea to get your head around, but on average, 2.1 children, that means the population will replace itself. And that's to compensate, you know, mother, father replacing themselves, but also that 0.1 is for those who don't survive childhood, also for people who emigrate. So 2.1 is the sweet number, and that's in healthy, developed populations. In a place where the child mortality rate's higher, where children don't survive into adulthood, it has to be a little bit higher than that. And what we have in places where the population is declining right now are rates that are well below 2.1. But then in places where the population is still growing, rates well above that. So take a place like Nigeria. Their fertility rate is over 5. It's about 5.4, 5.5. In South Korea, on the other end of the spectrum, it's less than 1. It's about 0.9.
Now, can I ask you about the countries where they have significantly over replacement rate? Are their birth rates also going down, actually?
Yes, they are absolutely going down. Nigeria, about 30 years ago, was closer to 8-9, and that's come down to just over 5, and they're consistently falling. And that's often to do with education, to do with more women in the workforce, urbanisation. When people move to cities, they tend to have less children, they've got less space. So everywhere, fertility rates are coming down. But in some places, they're well below replacement. In some places, they're well above it.
So you've mentioned a number of factors which could be behind women having fewer children, because that, at the end of it, is what we're talking about. Higher education, a better level of education, seems to be a significant factor there. Women going to work is a significant factor. And I imagine those two are interlinked anyway.
Well, education, interestingly, it's very closely linked to how long women stay in education. So the earlier you leave, the earlier you're likely to get married, the earlier you're likely to have children. If you start having children in your early 20s or your late teens, you've got a much longer time to have children, you're likely to have more. So when you have places that people are staying into education well into their 20s, hitting the workforce, then you start to see the average age that people have kids rise. And you see that in places like northern Nigeria or in Afghanistan, where fertility rates are really high. We also have lots of other factors, and one of the most important that you mentioned earlier is women being in work. We see that in Western Europe, you know, since the 1950s, our fertility rates have changed drastically. And that is because women are in the workplace. It's also because we've developed these economies that rely on two incomes in a household. And it becomes very unattractive then for many reasons to have more children, and it becomes expensive. So we've created in a lot of Western societies economies that aren't very conducive to having lots of children.
Are there countries, developed countries, which are bucking that trend?
Slightly and very marginally. But this highlights something really interesting about the choices that women make, well, that couples make around having children. So the only countries that have really had any success in trying to boost their fertility rate up are Scandinavian countries. Somewhere like Sweden, I think they got their fertility rate from 1.7 to 1.9. So it's quite a small bump, and it was also quite short-lived. But what they did was really increased benefits to young parents. They made maternity and paternity leave equally available to mothers and fathers, and made it very socially acceptable and expected for mothers and fathers to take the same amount of leave. And having spoken to sociologists and demographers in Scandinavia who've studied this phenomenon, what they think is happening is that once mothers and fathers take leave early, there is this balance of domestic work in the home, right? So men are more expected to get more involved in household chores. And those countries have some of the lowest imbalances when it comes to who does what at home. The countries with some of the highest imbalances, the developed countries, South Korea, China, Japan, they're countries that are seeing really low fertility rates. And I've spoken to women in these countries when I've been looking into this, and you hear it again and again. Young women are choosing not to have children because they don't want to work and then go home and have to do everything at home. It's just not an attractive lifestyle for them. And they're saying no thanks.
How does the UK currently compare?
Well, the UK is really interesting because our fertility rate here is below replacement. It's about 1.5, 1.6. So technically, you would think that we would start facing population decline. But that's not going to happen, it's predicted not to happen till about the 2060s, 2070s. And that's because we've been supplementing the population through immigration. And it's the same in the States. It's the same in a lot of healthy, booming, developed economies. But compared to Europe, It's not the lowest. You know, the UK's fertility rate is slightly higher.
Is there anywhere where the low birth rate has actually begun to lead to population loss?
Yes, there are lots of places, and we're seeing it in decline already in Japan, in Russia, and in China, actually. China's population started to decline this year, which was much earlier than expected. And next year, the UN is predicting that India will actually overtake China and its population. And these are places where they're really worried about this. You know, China's tried to put in policies to boost its fertility rate, to convince people to have more children, but they haven't really worked so far. And it's ironic because in the decades up to the 90s, the concern in China was that the population was booming, that it was growing too fast and they wouldn't be able to sustain it. Now they're having the opposite problem. It just shows you how difficult it is for governments to control people's fertility choices.
Stephanie Haggerty. Next, let's make this a bit more concrete by looking at some specific places. Italy is one of the countries where the population is actually declining. Marco Valerio Loprete is economics editor at Italian state broadcaster RAI and author of Italians, the Unhappy Few. Marco Valerio Loprete, can you just give us an idea of the scale of how Italy's population is changing demographically?
Italy is affected by a long-term demographic malaise. Total population, for example, it has been shrinking already since 2014, from over 60.5 million people to 58.9 million people. Already in the middle of the 90s, Italy was the first modern country to go through the so-called historic reversal. That means that people over 65 years old become more than people under 15 years old.
So Marco Valerio, what do you think are the underlying causes to this low birth rate?
So what is specific to Italy, I think one very close and strong family ties tend to make the anxiety of parents grow and the perceived cost of children grows too. So you see one more child as something that might cost a lot to your family. And also there is the problem of demographic denialism, because in Italy it has been forbidden for years to talk about demographic, even for historical reasons, because demographic policy was linked to the fascist regime back in the 30s of the last century.
How do these changes you've talked about affect the Italian economy?
Today in Italy, you have three people working for every two people who are retirees. Okay, so 3 to 2 is the ratio of working age people to retirees. In 2050, you will have one person working for every person who's retired. So you understand how it's becoming harder and harder to pay for pensions of people. Therefore, you have more and more tensions on public debt. Public debt that's 150% of its GDP.
What action have governments taken so far to try and alter the demographic trend?
Talking about policies, not much has been done until recently, I have to say. But recently, in 2021, actually, the Assegno Unico Universale was introduced by the Draghi government. You can translate it as a single or universal allowance for dependent children. Basically, this is an important measure. It changes according to the parents' income and wealth from 50 to 175 euro per month for each child that have less than 40,000 euros in income or assets.
Now, one obvious solution to this problem is to encourage more immigration, especially in a country which has a diminishing population, as you've told us Italy's does. How much have Italians embraced the idea of having immigrants not just to work, but also, frankly, to have children?
What is not well known is that it already has played a role in Italy. Just to give you an idea, in 1998, the foreign population of Italy was not even 2% of the total population, it was 1.7%. Today, it's around 9%. Immigration has been rising, has been contributing to the Italian demographics. The point is, it is not enough because, as I said, population is declining in Italy from 2014 and immigration never stopped. Even the official statistics say that the number of immigrants you should have to correct this such great imbalances wouldn't be enough. And there's another point. Migrants who came in Italy basically tend to adapt to the demographic habits of Italians. So they tend to have less children than when they're back home. So it can contribute to correct demographic imbalances, but immigration is not enough.
Marco Valerio Loprete. Now to the other side of the globe and South Korea, where the demographic trends are equally striking. Robert Kelly is Professor of Political Science at Pusan National University in South Korea. Robert Kelly, we heard earlier that South Korea is one of the lowest birth rates in the world. Why do you think this phenomenon is particularly acute in South Korea?
The general issues that you've covered, like modernization, sort of as people become wealthier, they get married later and have children later, those things are very noticeable here. There's also a lot of sort of cultural traditionalism here, which I think has not really shifted as Korea's economy has modernized. I think particularly male attitudes about family and women in the workplace have really not modernized. And this has sort of collided with younger women. I see this in, as a college professor myself, my younger women just don't want to sort of follow in the kind of traditional female role models that are provided to them. They want to sort of stay in school and they want to get higher degrees and make some money and travel and things like that. And, you know, their parents tell them to get married. And so I think there's sort of like a fairly severe culture clash here that has led to a sort of alienation by young women. I think the government hasn't been particularly responsive to them. I certainly hear that when I speak about this to women in Korea.
Very interesting. Has it led to a situation where South Korea all feels that its population is aging fast? In other words, is it clearly an aging society?
Just walking around, you can see it. You can go to like a mall or a subway station and you just see lots and lots of old people just kind of sitting around. You can feel that South Korea is aging. You can see it sort of in the infrastructural changes, things like buses that, you know, provide sort of like stairwell, you know, so robo stairs so elderly people can get on more easily and things like that. I mean, the society is developing a kind of gray infrastructure and it is costly. It's leading to sort of distributional issues about who's going to get welfare support from the government and, you know, should we send money to older people instead of to younger people in kindergartens and things like that. And so these issues are growing because it's happening so fast because the birth rate is so low.
So what have they been doing about the problem?
Yeah, to be honest, I think the Korean government primarily has sort of kicked the can down the road on this. Somebody who lives here, I'm actually fairly disappointed. I think they've really dropped the ball. The long-term solution to this is almost certainly immigration. You can try to get the birth rate up a little bit, but that hasn't worked very well in Europe. It probably won't work here. You're probably going to have immigration. And the Korean government's, for the last two decades, have kind of danced around this and not really dealt with it head on, not really talked about issues of racism and integration and how do we deal with ethnic minorities. I mean, that's just not a part of Korean politics. Instead, there's been a lot of money thrown at families and family development. So like my wife and I, you know, we have two kids in the Korean schools. I think we get like a couple $100 a month for our second child and we got like free kindergarten for him or something like that. So we've gotten a little bit of structural support over the years, but not really enough that I think that it alters the financial choices that I make or my wife and I are making or that like a lot of our colleagues are making. You know, the work environment would really need to change. Just throwing money at the problem is really not enough because it's more about the structure of the workplace and the culture, I think, than simply cash.
Those people who are not kicking the can down the road, those people who are trying to come up with serious policy possibilities, what kind of things are they suggesting?
There seem to be sort of three broad options. The one is to try to get the birth rate up. But as we know from the experience of the other cases you've discussed, it's very hard to get birth rates back up. Immigration is the most obvious answer. You know, in a country like the United States, that's a lot easier. I'm an American. It's easier because we have an immigrant culture. We're sort of used to absorbing new people. But Koreans have a pretty distinct sense of who they are sort of culturally and arguably even racially. And I think an immigration debate here is going to be pretty tough. There's one other possibility, and that would be unification with North Korea. But that is, you know, that's kind of a wild card.
It's a wild card, but you might like to explain it to us. Why would that help you?
Well, of course, I mean, you know, North Korea has, you know, 23 million other people who identify as Koreans, and their birth rate is a little bit higher. But it's worth noting that their birth rate is also below the replacement rate. They're not contracting at the rate of South Korea, but North Korea's population is also stagnant. So, you know, unification, if it happens, which I would say that's very far off, but if it does happen, it buys you some time. But it still doesn't deal with the structural and the cultural issues that you and I have been talking about, right? Male domination and family and sort of male expectations about women in the workplace. Those things will not be changed by unification.
Robert Kelly. So two examples of rather astonishing changes in reproductive behaviour. Finally, I want to explore the long-term impact of ageing populations and falling birth rates and look at the ways in which governments might tackle them. Stepping into the briefing room are Camilla Cavendish, senior fellow at Harvard University and author of Extra Time, 10 Lessons for an Aging World, and Ian Golden, professor of globalization and development at the Oxford Martin School. Camilla Cavendish, could we start by looking at what governments might be able to do to mitigate these huge demographic shifts? From what you've seen, are there any effective policy options out there for getting women to have more babies?
Well, David, there aren't very many. There's quite a few governments which have tried really, really hard. I sometimes show a slide from the Danish campaign to get more women to have children, which is called Do It for Denmark. Astonishingly, women have been utterly unmoved by this campaign, but these are the lengths that governments will go to try and raise the birth rate. There are a few examples where the birth rate has bucked the trend. One is Israel, where I think the rate is just over 3. And that is very interesting, but that may just be a particular thing about feeling that you're part of Israel and you need to grow the population. But there are two others that I think are worth dwelling on, where essentially governments are giving people more money and more time. One is Germany, where actually they have very generous parental leave and they encourage people to file joint tax returns, and that has made a bit of a difference. And the other one is Estonia, where they have a hugely generous parental leave package. They basically pay you your full income for 15 months. But what I would say is that none of these are making a vast impact.
What could we do in order to try and make sure that we are not subject to an ever-aging population and possibly a declining population? What about immigration, Ian?
Immigration is very powerful, and Camilla cited Israel as being above the trend. That's partly because of the number of immigrants into Israel who ultra-Orthodox. In fact, migrants around the world tend to have higher levels of fertility. They also lower burdens on society often because they come when they're adults, they leave often when they're pensioners, and they put in much more than they get out. So immigration is certainly a key dimension of it. There are other things that societies need to do. They need to ensure that elderly people stay fitter longer. So there's enormous need to ensure that older people aren't a growing burden on taxes. And of course, constantly keeping up to date in terms of how they understand the world and knowledge. So continual learning, adult education, things like that become very significant as well. The whole question of retirement ages, whether elderly people can work, whether they can work part-time, is incredibly important as well. So ensuring that young people are more productive, old people are not a growing burden, and I think increasing immigration are all things that can be done.
Camilla, sticking with this question of immigration, we'll come to some of the other questions in a moment. We've already heard how difficult that can be politically in some of the countries that have very low birth rates. Do you think that the politics around immigration really have to change over the next few years?
I think potentially they do. I mean, if you look at the US, there's been a significant drop in birth rate since 2016, and there's been a significant drop in immigration. And that was because a president was elected who was elected on a mandate to reduce it. And actually, that has really changed the trend for America, which had otherwise been quite confident about its population. I mean, the obvious thing to conclude would be the old West is shrinking, and part of old Asia is shrinking. And the bits that are growing are sub-Saharan Africa and India. And the logical thing to do would be to take people from one and shove them into the other. It's not quite that simple. It could be that simple. Some places are too big. China is too big to solve its problems through immigration. Other places, you mentioned South Korea, Japan is another one, they just don't want it. They think it will wreck their culture. But the other aspect of all this, David, is that what we're seeing is that immigrants themselves, once they move, tend to take on the norms of the countries they move to. So the bonus you get probably only lasts one or two generations, and then people start having just as few children as everybody else.
That's the point at which we start talking about adaptation, because what you're both saying suggests that even with immigration, we nevertheless face a significant long-term issue of an ageing and declining population. So let's talk in about how we would mitigate that. Ian, first, what happens to economies when there are fewer and fewer younger people and more older ones?
What happens to them very much depends on how the economy responds. But typically what happens is there's a growing burden of dependency. So for each working age person in the population, they're more and more dependents. And that means that the working age people that are producing things and are paying tax are supporting more and more elderly. And of course, the older you are, the higher the cost of elderly care. So as you go into populations where many people are living into their late 80s and 90s and increasing incidences of neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, that burden escalates very, very sharply. So where the revenue comes from to pay for care is one absolutely critical question. Another question is, of course, whether you are able to keep people productive through their whole working lives. And there the evidence is that you can, and there's no lower levels of productivity for people, say, in their 60s to in their 30s in most jobs, but it's very difficult to improve the efficiency of care. So you don't want someone to be looking after your elderly parent more quickly, for example. And that means that a growing share of the economy, you cannot increase the productivity of. That also slows down growth. So we should expect lower and slower growth as a result of this in many, many instances. And again, what happens with immigration is absolutely critical because that can provide a lot of a solution.
Camilla Cavendish, what about other economic difficulties which lie ahead?
Well, I think we're just far too unambitious about older people. So I think the whole game has actually changed and we haven't noticed. So I've been talking about the people who are living in what I call extra time. They are young old, the Japanese call them young old, until they're about 80. And all the economic models tell you that everybody stops working at the age of 65. Well, that's just not true anymore. So in the US and the UK, about one in four people are actually unretiring and going back to work in their 60s and sometimes their 70s, and they're actually pretty productive. Part of the problem is that we have constructed our society around the notion that everybody kind of gives up at that point. Now, there's two groups in society. There's another group which is getting sicker and frailer, and we desperately, urgently need to address that. But I actually think it's not old age that's getting longer, it's middle age, and there are many, many things we can do to take advantage of that.
Like?
Well, if we raise the retirement age in line with life expectancy, governments are very reluctant to do that, of course. If we were willing to offer people jobs in their 50s, it's extremely hard to get back into the labour force in your 50s if you've been made redundant. We've even seen that now since the pandemic. People who lost their jobs in the pandemic in their 50s, finding it very hard to be hired back in by people who are in their 30s. We need to totally reframe that conversation.
Camilla, in your research, have you seen any good examples of successful older societies?
Well, I would say Japan is one. So Japan has a series of what they call silver centres, which were actually started by a Tokyo professor who thought, wait a minute, I don't want to stop working at 60. It was opposed by the government for years, and I went and sat in one of these, and there are a whole bunch of women in their 80s and 90s coming together to make products for local businesses. Now, it's kind of also a coffee morning, but these women are getting on sometimes two buses every day to go to this centre. Exactly as Ian says, it's about having a sense of purpose actually keeps you going. I think Japan's done very well on that, and it's one of the only countries in the world that is actually improving healthy life expectancy, so pushing out this twilight zone, where, as Ian said earlier, you might get dementia.
Camilla, let's talk a bit about the politics of this. You did quite a lot of advice to governments in Downing Street for a while. Presumably, some of these thoughts were burgeoning then, but they never got expression, did they?
No, I mean, when you sit at the heart of government, you have to make 25 decisions a day and events happen. And the truth is that the long-term slow-burning trend doesn't get that much attention. What you do see at the heart of government is this looming and terrifying expenditure on healthcare, on disability, on pensions. And everybody's aware of that, but no, there's very, very little discussion really about how to move the dial. And I don't really think governments solve these kind of problems. One of the reasons I went around the world and interviewed people was that I wanted to show that individual people and groups can themselves refine age and refine the way we think about it. And that's actually what's happening. Civil society is changing it. There are people in Germany who are adopting grandchildren who they're not even related to. I mean, they're adopting single-parent families who really need help. We're sort of breaking down the whole notion of family. And governments are just sort of way behind this, to be honest.
That's a very interesting point, isn't it, Ian? We talk all the time as if governments hold the key to what happens. And then actually we're confronted with social trends that haven't depended upon governments at all or hardly depended upon governments. In fact, usually governments follow in their wake.
Yes, I think the challenge we face is that older people will become a bigger and bigger share of the voting population. And as the voting population ages, they have a stronger and stronger influence, and they, I think, will be voting for things that are in their favour, and that can be discriminatory against the young. So, for example, I think it does act as a conservative brake on societies, and it also is shorter term. Older people are less concerned about things that might happen in 30, 40 years' time on climate change, for example, than younger people might be. They are not open to big changes in housing markets because their wealth is in housing, whereas young people are being often excluded from it, can't afford it. I think older people are more anti-immigration, even though they would benefit from cheaper care. So it does lead, I think, to sclerosis in government, and that needs to be guarded against. There are ways of thinking about that. But, you know, by 2050, over half the population is projected in virtually all OECD countries to be over 65. And given that people under 18 can't vote, that means older people will dominate the politics. And that, I think, has very strong implications that we need to address if we're to embrace change in the future.
Ian Golden there with Camilla Cavendish. My thanks to them and Stephanie Haggerty, Marco Valerio Lopretti and Robert Kelly. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Simon Watts, Dan Gordon and Octavia Woodward. The editor was Richard Varden. And the engineers were Rod Farker and Neil Churchill. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to our back catalogue. You'll find there recent episodes on Britain's trades unions and the world's plans for colonising the moon. Just search for The Briefing Room on BBC Sounds.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis, and I want to tell you about a podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called The New Gurus, and it's about how everywhere you look on the internet, people are giving advice. Advice they claim will transform your life. Advice that gets them thousands, no, millions of devoted followers. These online prophets are telling us how to eat, how to think, how to get rich, how to find love, how to manage our time. These are the new gurus.
Just as people will say the Protestant Reformation and the printing press went hand in hand, so too did this birth of the new internet culture really give rise to this new religious landscape.
Subscribe now to The New Gurus on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.